And now for the podcast, asking the all-important question, how you doing? This is Not All Podcasts Wear Capes.
I thought you were going to go with the doing your mom.
Doing your mom?
that would be, yeah, that would be the one.
No, and I wasn't going to steal your joke. The audience
already knows the expressions on
Ariane and his face. It is a very Jersey introduction because...
I mean, I'm the paisan on the podcast. I got to dig deep for that one.
Yeah, ladies, gentlemen, and those beyond the binary, welcome to our podcast. I'm T, that's Spade. Hello. And La Ciguapa herself. Ariane.
Pew, pew, pew.
What's up, everybody?
What's happening? All right, so what are we talking about today, Spade?
Well, I think we're going to do some catch-up pod, right, on Dune Part 1. We just saw Dune Part 2. And over the weekend, I actually watched the 1984 version of Dune. So I think we're just going to Dune the whole podcast on everything.
We're going to be, wait for it, doing it up. On the podcast. There you go.
Come on, Ariane. Hit us with a pun.
We're doing it and doing it and doing it well.
There you go. Did you have that one in the chamber?
Yeah.
Did you were thinking that was saving? Nice.
Yeah.
Nice. All right. So we are only 3-4 days out of seeing Dune Part 2 in the theaters, the whole pod.
Or three, four years after Dune Part 1, right? Or 40 years after Dune 1980, whatever. So
when was the original? When was the first Part 1 released?
2021, I believe.
Yeah.
That's only 2 years.
It's 2024.
It's 2024.
Yeah, but it's early 2024.
Yeah.
All right.
Less than three years.
This movie was supposed to come out in November, but it got delayed
because of
the strikes. So it would have been like a 2 year difference originally.
Okay, everybody, all the audience, if you're gonna hear my dog, I can't do anything anymore. We're just gonna have to edit around my dog, playing around. So if you hear any kind of
that's right, we know your dog likes
it's nothing. It's nothing weird. It's my dog.
It's T's pet sandworm, and Ariane's frozen again.
She's frozen.
Yeah, that's all right, T. Let's Dune it without her.
Let it go, let it go. Anymore. You know what? The cold never bothered her anyway. But how about the heat in Dune? What did you think about this one, Spade?
I was feeling the heat. You know, they did a nice job in this movie of creating the atmosphere that you were in. I mean, when they were hot and sweating, I felt like I was hot and sweating in the movie theater. They did a really good job of just creating the planet atmosphere that they were on.
So, Ariane, are you back there? Are you back?
We lost you for a little bit.
I don't know what's going on. Okay, sorry. Okay, I'm good. The last thing I heard, something about T asking about the heat, and I don't know if he was being suggestive or not.
I think he was trying to.
Right.
And I didn't take the bait.
No, because Spade said you were frozen, and then I started singing Let It Go.
That's right.
Oh. And then it went from frozen to But Let's Feel the Heat with Dune or something like that. Okay, I was trying to.
Yeah. We were basically spinning our wheels till you came back on. And
Right.
Okay. Yeah. I think we're back in business. Sorry about that.
I think we should do this because I made no notes, right? My context for Dune is different because, I mean, I read the books when I was a teenager. This is an interesting story, and my family who listens to this will appreciate it.
Is this about how you lost your virginity when you went to see Batman again?
During Batman? No.
Please.
But that was a good one, right?
I can't imagine what could possibly top that.
That was 1989, a number of another summer. When Dune was released, my family...
The book or the...
The movie. I wasn't alive yet when the... I'm not that old when the book was...
The book came out, the original came out like...
No, but you know, I didn't know if this was one of those stories that started before you were born. Like, before I was born, my father bought the books the day they came out from Frank Herbert himself. You know what I mean? I don't know.
Out of the trunk of his car.
Right.
So our family went to the movie theater. We had yet to decide what movie we were going to see, right? And this is like typical for my nuclear family, is that we were in there in the lobby going, oh, let's see this, oh, let's see that. So what we did is off my brother, my father, my mom, and me, we all went to see a different movie. So I went and I saw Dune, right? My brother went to go see the sequel to 2001, A Space Odyssey with Roy Schneider. It was 2010, the year we made Contact.
Oh, cool.
My mom went to see Out of Africa, if I remember correctly. Ariana, you could check that if I remember it correctly. And they were
if they're all in the movies at the same time.
Right, right. But that's what I remember. And then my father went to go see a Dudley Moore film where he romances some cello player that's way too young for him. I remember it's a Dudley Moore film. And then we went out to see that. And I was there alone. And I was young, and I went in there going to think, because they marketed it to teenagers as, and I was a young teenager, I think. When did it come out?
1984,
right?
Yeah.
1984, so I was 13.
Out of Africa, because that did not come out until 1985. So your mom must have seen something else. It was in December.
Something similar. Out of Africa, or maybe Gandhi.
Gandhi, I think, came out like later.
I don't know. I'll ask her.
Gandhi is like,
but everybody split up and they all went to a different movie. That's the moral of the story.
But it was something Out of Africa like. So I'm there, and you know, it marketed to kids as Star Wars, and I went in there and was like, my first experience with David Lynch. I was 13 years old, and I'm going in like, is this going to be like Star Wars? And I'm like, wow, this isn't like Star Wars, but this is really good. And then I went and I heard, this is the most terrible movie ever. And I'm like, no, I really like this movie. This was a good movie. There was a lot of really cool science fiction stuff here. And then that's when I started picking up the books to read them. So and I didn't make it through all of the Dune books. I got through most of it.
How many books are there?
Dune Messiah, Children of Dune, God Emperor of Dune, Heretics of Dune, Chapter House Dune. Those are six books by Frank Herbert. His son and Kevin J. Anderson, another science fiction writer, have written dozens of books. So there's dozens of books coming out by his son.
Are they still making them, or?
Yeah, there's always a new one at the Barnes & Noble. Every couple of years, there's a new one.
Is it kind of like a Star Wars thing? Like the Dune story that we just saw, that's the main story, and then right, all this other stuff right, branches off kind of thing?
Yeah, they'll like do a house. Like there was a book called House Carino, we'll call House Atreides, and the House Atreides book is like when Duke Leto was younger or something like that. There's a lot of them. There's one called the Butlerian Jihad, which is a really important concept in Dune, and we should touch on that. Well, I'll touch on it right now since we're touching on it. Why am I saying touching on it? That's really creepy. Because
you're talking about the Butlerian. Go ahead, touch away.
The touching the Butlerian Jihad.
Wow.
So really important concept of Dune. Why are there, it's 20,000 years in the future, 30,000 years in the future. Why are there no robots or computers? That's because there's a Butlerian Jihad where there was a whole war throughout the galaxy about putting an end to artificial intelligence. And then it comes out with like one of Isaac Asimov's laws of robotics, but it goes like this. It goes, thou shalt not make a machine in the image of a human mind.
So it's kind
of
like what we're dealing with right now with AI and everything, right? Skynet.
Really, 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 really important. I bagged out and it's not that I didn't like it, but it was just kind of, I don't remember if it was in Heretics or Chapter House. I didn't finish all six books. I got through five and a half, I probably just started the last book. But the last two, I feel that if you're going to do a Dune movie series, you have to go all the way through God Emperor. I think you have to make it
to God
Emperor.
So that's how many books? Four?
There's six books.
No, I'm saying the book that you're mentioning would be the fourth.
Right, right. Got it for fourth book, yeah.
Okay.
It's the fourth
book. So what we saw, right, Dune 1 and or Part 1 and Dune Part 2, that's the first book, right?
First book, yeah, first book. And the best one.
So I was a little harsh on the first one when we first saw it. I thought it was long and boring, to be honest. And I rewatched it you know, a week and a half ago before going to see part two, T paused me, so I'll just hang out.
You said, oh, you want me to keep going? I think that means keep going. Okay.
All right. My main criticisms of Dune 1 is that it's long and boring. I don't totally subscribe to that now, having seen the David Lynch version, because there is just, you know, if you've seen Dune 1 and Dune 2, it's basically all that story condensed in 2 hours. So there's no time for anything to breathe. And it's just going from one character to the next. And like Duncan Idaho is in that movie, I think for what, one, maybe two scenes? Like he's in and out so fast. You're on mute. We can't hear you.
Yeah, briefly. He's very, very briefly in that, yeah.
Right, because I remember...
You don't really get a sense of his relationship with Paul because he's in it.
Well, and anybody,
that's the,
really.
That's the only thing they show. That's the only thing they show, that they have some kind of warmth, and that's all you get.
Right. And, I mean, there was one point where... Because, I mean, you, now that I, like I said, I've seen both of these new ones, you can feel where the story's going. You know what I mean? You're like, oh, I know exactly what's going to happen. I know how, you know, how this is going to end. But where in the newer version, let's say there was still like an hour left of story, in the David Lynch version, there was like 12 minutes.
Wow.
So I'm like, okay, they have like literally 45 minutes to an hour of story that they're going to wrap up probably in the next 6 minutes when you count the credits and stuff like that. You know what I mean? And they basically just sped through everything. But it's not as built out as what Denny did. And the scenes are just like 3 or 4 people in a room max. Right, T?
Yeah. I mean, it's been a while since I saw the David Lynch Dune. So let's go with some of the highlights. The score by Toto.
Oh, Toto's the best.
Have you heard that?
You guys know the lead singer of Toto, his John Williams' son, right?
I did not know that.
I didn't know that either.
Yeah.
Does that lie under insufferable pandering nepotism?
I mean, Toto
made Africa, so you know.
Yeah, I think they've more than proven themselves.
So when Paul makes Arrakis, puts the oceans that you saw in part two, they should put that. I've seen the rains down in Africa. They could just cut to that.
Basically, if you wanted to.
Yeah. Sure. That score by Toto. Amazing. It's almost a little bit like the at certain points it starts feeling like the Queen soundtrack for Flash Gordon. Certain parts it starts getting there.
It's very much a time capsule of the 80s in terms of effects and acting and, you know, visual flair and all that kind of stuff.
It's a lot of good actors in that movie. I was just like, wow, this is like
amazing. Max von Sydow.
But here, let's run through them. So people probably don't even know. Patrick Stewart's in it. He plays Gurney.
Gurney Howard,
who is the character that Josh Brolin plays in a new version.
Right.
Paul Atreides is
Kyle MacLachlan.
Yep.
I think that's his first movie.
Is it?
I think so, and obviously it's his first collaboration with David Lynch, and they're, you know, buddies.
No, well, Kyle MacLachlan? No, the first one was Blue Velvet, I thought.
No, Blue Velvet came out in, like, the late 80s, or, like, early 90s. Blue Velvet wasn't first.
I don't know. I'm going to believe 9 Green Squares on this one, T.
All right, keep on going.
Sting plays Fraid, right?
Fade. Ralph.
Okay. And, there's somebody else that's in it that's a pretty big... Oh, Max von Sydow, you said.
Jose Ferrer is the emperor.
Right.
Jose Ferrer is a big deal.
Yeah, he is.
But in terms of bigger characters, I think that's kind of it, right, T?
Yeah, Sean Young played Chani. And hold on. Dune was in 1984.
Yeah.
Linda Hunt?
Shout out Mapes. She played the Shout Out Mapes. Shout Out Mapes was a servant that they had. She had a pretty big role in that.
Couple scenes, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, and you go through and you think about it. There's other people in there hidden. My IMDb isn't popping.
Dean Stockwell.
Right, Dean Stockwell. Right, he played the Mentant for the House Harkonnen.
Harkonnen, not Harkonnen, right? That's.
How do you say it? Atreides or Atreides?
Paul Atreides. Atreides.
Atreides nuts, boy. I got it.
Doing good with that one, T. Doing good.
Oh, Lord.
That's funny.
I was waiting for that.
I have something then to say about, I guess, the difference between this version and the one we've just seen. So there's been a lot of complaints, especially in Hollywood lately, about splitting movies that don't need to be split. Do you think then, well, Spade and also T, do you think then this movie benefits from the story being split in half to really like flesh out the, there's a lot of stuff like going on in this movie.
Absolutely. 100%. I would even go as far as I think it needs more time. And I think that the way that they tried to do it on the Sci-Fi Channel, I think that's the kind of time you need. I get that you can't do, even with today's technology and things, you can't do what Villeneuve did, especially in the second one with the visuals. I mean,
on a TV budget.
We'll talk about that. But the story needs that time. Because even with the two films, so much stuff is left out. And it's been a while, so like my memory for things, I know the big broad strokes, and I know a lot of different things. I wish that this kind of thing, you were able to see, they were able to do it in 8 hours, you know? This needed 8 hours.
How long is the book? Is this like a Game of Thrones length, like 800-page novel kind of thing? Or longer?
I don't remember. If I remember correctly, I'm thinking like 400.
Okay.
I'm thinking maybe 400 pages.
It says Wikipedia says it's 896 pages.
Oh, geez.
That's a huge book.
You said you only read half the book, right? So maybe you quit on the first one and didn't realize it.
No. But included in that is a glossary in the back. Where you had to, like, I remember as I'm reading it, I had to go look stuff up in the back because they'll say stuff. And you go to the back with all the words, all the made-up titles and the names and the Kwisatz Haderach and all the things about Larry and Jihad. You have to go to the back of the book and read it and then go back. So there was a lot of going back and forth with that.
That was going to be one of my questions. Like, a lot of the terms, like the Kwisatz Haderach and you know, the Bene Gesserit and stuff like that, like, in the David Lynch version, they don't really explain any of that, kind of. It's left to, like, they do a lot of internal monologue from the character. There was a lot of that going on, where I wasn't sure, I'm like, is this weird, like, dubbing of the 80s where the character's lips aren't moving with the audio and that kind of stuff? But then I realized, oh, no, they're just doing a lot of inner monologue, but they were doing it with, like, everybody.
I think that's what I liked about this movie, is that it was honestly, like, really accessible. When I watched Dune Part 1, because I have no real concept of Dune, except that I knew a lot of, like, sci-fi and fantasy and Star Wars. Like, I knew it took a lot of inspiration from it. I was worried that I was going to be lost while watching this movie, just because I thought the world building was going to be really, like, weird and really intense. It's going to have all these weird words, and it does. Like,
going back to Dune 1, yeah, right? Not just Dune 2.
Just Dune 1, like, just being immersed in, like, this world, like, in the first place. But I think because they let things play out and they let things, like, actually take their time and people, like, talk and you kind of, like, see how this world is and what it is and who these people are and their relationships with each other, it's honestly, like, really accessible. Like, really, really accessible. And I was like, you know what? This isn't as bad as I thought it was. Especially because it's just political drama more than anything, and family drama.
Game of Thrones is two things. Game of Thrones is one, Dune, right? Because they took all this stuff about house this, house that, house Lannister. And you could see a lot of the parallels there. The Emperor, you have, you know, and they kind of, he mixes it up.
And strategic marriages and stuff like that.
Right. People getting poisoned. It's really deadly being the noble class.
And witches interfering and all that. And
right.
It's the Quentin Tarantino thing. Steal a little bit from here, a little bit from there, a little bit from there, and mix it together.
Right.
You know?
I know, but Game of Thrones is also stole a lot from a 1980s, poorly written but very beloved Dragonlance D&D novel series, but we won't get into that. But we should do next time we do a Game of Thrones, I'm going to go deep with that. But anyway. But yeah, I'm sorry. What were you guys saying? I jumped in with like a...
No, Ariane was just talking about the accessibility of the first one.
It's kind
of
crazy that this movie, like the first Dune, made a lot of money while being like, I think did it get released in theaters simultaneously? I don't remember.
I watched that at home. You guys watched that at home too, right?
I don't remember if I watched it at home.
It was on HBO Max. It was an HBO Max day and date.
It was a day and date thing, right? The first movie had a budget of $165 million. It made almost $435 million at the box office, which is crazy for a movie that was released day and date.
That was only $165
million. $165 million, and it looks that good. And I'm going to give a lot of credit. Denis Villeneuve is amazing. I'm giving a lot of credit to Greg Fraser, who was a cinematographer. And he's the one who kind of developed the whole...
Amazing.
He developed the volume. He is the only cinematographer who knows how to use the volume.
And this was a lot of volume. There was a lot of volume here.
The only volume stuff I really felt was the frayed, the black and white stuff. To me, I was thinking, oh, this is definitely a volume shot. Yeah.
Yeah.
But other than that, I mean, I'm sure a lot of the desert stuff probably was. You just don't know.
That worked. I mean, the volume shot worked in there because they were shooting, what, ultraviolet light? Or infrared? Ultraviolet or infrared? That whole scene, so like the people, the human skin was translucent. It really did these really, really
interesting it's really, really things. Cool. It was really,
yeah.
You know,
great. It wasn't just black and white.
Right.
It was
right.
Something that was something else. That was something else. All props to the cinematographer, but I don't know where I heard this today because I've gotten a lot of Dune information that Villeneuve has been storyboarding Dune since.
Like he was a kid or something. Yeah, I heard that too.
Did you tell me that?
Mr. Sunday Movies. We listened to the same podcast today. They said it.
Yeah. Those dudes don't know anything about Dune. They know, like, I'm hearing them, and it's like I turned it off because it was nails on chalkboard. They didn't know what the hell they were talking about.
But, well, I mean, it's like me and Ariane. We saw the movies, and we thought they were.
But it's like they didn't even watch the movie. It was like so bad they didn't even like know the names or anything. Anyway, Ariane, you were talking. I'm sorry, I cut you off, Mariani. Mariani.
I called her Mariani. Mariani Rivera.
She's a relief pitcher.
Hey, sportball reference. You got it, T.
You got to close the deal. You were saying that
the cinematographer
needed mad props. Yeah,
and he won the Oscar for the first Dune.
No, is he the same guy that did Blade Runner?
I'm pretty sure he also did Blade Runner. He did the Batman.
Okay, Villeneuve did Arrival. Great film. Based on real ideas. Science fiction based on ideas. Yeah, I love it. You know, real ideas.
Roger Deakins was the cinematographer for Blade Runner.
Okay. I wasn't sure if Denny was this guy that worked with the same people all the time, like Christopher Nolan kind of thing.
Even Christopher Nolan has been switching it up. He's worked with Oppenheimer and Tenet. He worked with Hoyts van Hoytma, who's great. He's really cool.
That just sounds like you made that up right on the spot.
That is making fun of people.
That sounds like you're making fun of people's names.
Wait, his name is Hoyt.
What's his name? Hoyt van Hoytma.
Yeah, but wait, Ariani's point to tell me that Christopher Nolan has been working with different people is to tell me he worked with the same guy in two different movies.
Yeah, I know. But before that, Nolan, I think, worked with. I don't remember who he worked with on.
Listen, as a director. You find a cinematographer, director, or DP that you dig, and you stick with them because that's a trust relationship.
Someone that thinks like you and can execute whatever you need.
Right, and you're speaking like that's like a couple skating pairs. You need to know the person's moves and everything. You need to know what they want. You know.
Yeah. Oh, Wally Feister was Nolan's regular guy. Yeah, Spielberg has worked with the same guy like his whole career.
But all right, let's really dive into Dune 2. Like we've kind of been like touching on things here and there, but so I'm just going to flat out ask, do you guys like this movie?
Yes, I loved it. I like both of these movies, but I really enjoyed part 2. I think it's doing
I thought this was great.
I was like, I'm so serious. What these movies are doing, we haven't seen since Lord of the Rings. I'm so serious. Just in terms of like what they're doing in terms of scale, in terms of story,
mm-hmm.
in terms of how they're treating the story, how they're treating the audience.
I think the word epic is thrown around way too much. But this is epic filmmaking.
It is epic filmmaking. This is what people want to see when it's epic filmmaking. Like,
right.
It's what it's made for.
Yeah.
Right. And I think your Lord of the Rings comparison is like spot on, because when those movies were coming out, I was like, I can't wait for the next one to see how this is gonna turn out. But I'm wondering if, you know, like in comparison to like Marvel and stuff like that, like Marvel is just a continuing story, right? So they know where they're gonna go, but they don't really know where they're gonna go. They can pivot at any time. With Lord of the Rings and with this, like, the story's already written, so you kind of know where it ends, so you can kind of plan better. I wonder if that kind of helps too, and it expands with, you know, the experience that you have as a moviegoer.
I mean that's a thing versus like does the director write the story as well? Is this writer director kind of thing? I mean Scorsese's Killers of the Flower Moon was a book, you know. I mean, it's like you take these stories. Screenwriters write scripts and they hand them to directors. You know what I mean? It's this kind of idea of, I think every movie is different, and every movie getting made is some kind of customized, bespoke
mini miracle kind of thing.
Mini miracle, right?
It's a miracle any movie exists.
Right, right. Anything got made. I think it matters in the sense that Denis Villeneuve read these books. He's a little bit older than me. How old is he? 58?
Sure.
But, you know, I was there with, you know, him, like, in spirit reading those books as a kid, kind of using the imagination.
He's 56.
Right. I'm right there. What I'm impressed was is, audience, that I know Spade was being snarky and just trying to, like, troll us in the thing, but leading up to the movie, he's like, oh, it's going to be crap. It's going to be like the first one. It's going to be long and boring. But he came out, and at the end, he was like, this was really good, man.
It was. I mean, I was cautiously optimistic. I mean, the previews, honestly, I don't even know if I watched any of the previews for this movie. Ariane's good for sending videos around. I'm just like, I'm not watching these. I'll just watch the movie when I watch it. And you know what? I was pleasantly surprised by this, because I was expecting more of the same from the first one, but it wasn't. I shouldn't say it wasn't that, because it's not that the first one's bad, because I don't think that at all. And especially after seeing the second one and then going back and watching the 1984 version, I have a new appreciation for part one. You know, it's a visual masterpiece. Yeah, it is a bit on the long side. There's a lot of, I know we always talk about sweeping shots and stuff, like you could probably cut about 15 minutes of that, you know, and just make the story a little tighter. But seeing how fast the 1984 version moved, if I didn't see these two movies, I don't know that I would have really picked up on who all the characters were and what their relationships were, you know? So I think gives me new appreciation for part one. And I just watched it 2 weeks ago.
I had a special place in my heart for the David Lynch Dune. We won't even talk about Jodorowsky's Dune, because everybody's like, oh, it would have been great. It would have been terrible. And the reason why it would have been terrible.
So Jodorowsky's Dune doesn't exist, but I hear about it so much.
Right. Right. Because somebody did a documentary. Like a concept. Right. And he wanted to have Salvador Dali as the emperor, all these things.
Wow.
By the way, I'm not a big fan of Salvador Dali. Oh, so whenever boy. He's brought up, here it's kind of like if you bring up you know, H.P. Lovecraft, you have to kind of say, oh, he was a racist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Salvador Dali, every time he comes in, he was a sellout and he's not a good person.
I don't know about you. I'm trying to sell out. Somebody sponsor us, please.
I'm trying to retire. I was worried, and I liked Dune Part One, and I have criticisms of Part One and Part Two, and I won't get into it because they're minor and they're quibbles, and I won't.
It wouldn't be a movie if you didn't have a quibble or a quarrel with it.
Denis Villeneuve stuck this landing in a way that I didn't think possible. And it becomes the reason why is because after Dune and 1984 and what Jodorowsky was planning on doing, is the idea that this is not a victory. This is Revenge of the Sith. This is Paul Atreides turns into Darth Vader. He succumbs. the Bene Gesserit are the Sith. He becomes the one.
The Night Sisters, terrible, basically, right?
A terrible. Yeah, of course. Every the Fremen are the Tusken Raiders. Arrakis is Tatooine. We could do a whole show about detailing the all the things Lucas. Yeah, but Lucas lifted from everybody. You know, Dam Busters shot for shot. You know, Flash Gordon, whatever. We could go for hours. And at the end, when he's like, take them to paradise, because one of the biggest, and I'm not going to spoil anything, one of the things about reading the Dune series that stuck in my head the most is the first opening, and it's been a long time, so I might be getting this wrong, but near the beginning, maybe the first few pages of Dune Messiah, it's this holy war. And all of a sudden, there's a description of awful, awful things that Paul Atreides is doing in the galaxy. And it was so important because this isn't Dances with Wolves. This is not a white savior movie, because it could be Ferngully, it could be this, it could be whatever it is. A white savior goes and helps the native people, blah, 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 blah.
Avatar, right? To the more contemporary Avatar comparison.
Keep on going. This is an anti-white savior movie.
Well, it's an anti-cult of personality. It's the dangers of...
Anti-cult of person... Right.
Danger of messianic
figures, right.
Religion and politics and all that. And
I thought, when that came in and they said, the houses of the Lanzerat are refusing to recognize your ascension. I was like, that's right. And then the way they show Paul talking to the Siege in Villeneuve's, and then when he's talking to the Siege and he's rallying up the fighters, right? And he's talking to it in David Lynch's. David Lynch is like, yay, honorable. And it's tragic here in the Villeneuve. Chani walks away.
That was a big change that people were talking about, that they gave Chani more agency.
In the David Lynch film, and if I remember correctly in the books, I mean, obviously there are more filled out characters in the books, but sometimes they're just standing behind Paul. Lady Jessica and Chani are just standing behind. Like, he always has a bunch of women standing behind him. And I think one of the amazing things they did with the tension between Lady Jessica and Paul, that they're working at odds, and taking Chani, which I don't think is in the books, that she refuses to recognize Paul. Everybody falls in line in the book.
Yeah, I mean, the David Lynch movie, since I just saw it, it wraps it up in a really nice bow. Like,
and it's like, yay, he won.
Yeah, it's A New Hope getting the medal put on your neck. You know what I mean? It's that kind of
right.
Thing. Yeah.
Right. And because I saw the David Lynch version first, and he didn't get final cut, so I don't blame David Lynch. You could see the interviews of the struggle he had with that movie. And then I read the books and I'm like, wow, this is more complicated than all that. And then Villeneuve goes and he does it like so well. I'm so Ariane, because when you sent the clip of Monty Python's The Life of Brian, it's like the same scene.
It's literally
that
the
he
exact
was
same
doing.
Scene. Like, as soon as Stilgar, who Javier Bardem is so good in this movie.
He stole every scene.
There's a lot of MVPs. He's one of them.
He's going to be Galactus. Okay, sorry.
But the part where he's just like, you know, Paul is just like, I'm not the Kwisak Haderach. I'm not the Lisan Al Gaib. He's like, no. And he's like,
the Lisan Al Gaib is humble. The Lisan Al Gaib is humble.
He would never admit to being, he's the true Lisan Al Gaib because he's so humble. And it's just like, oh,
I am
God.
The Lisan Al Gaib. He's the Lisan Al
he was so good. And it's like, you get so lost in it. Like, I kept forgetting it's Javier Bardem because he just doesn't look like how he usually looks in
movies.
Well,
he does a different. He's an actor.
Yeah,
he does it different. He does different characters. He's not the same guy in every movie.
I think when Villeneuve went on like a talk show or something, or somebody went on a talk show, and I think it was Stephen Colbert. He said that Javier Bardem was the most immersed character in the movie. Like, he, like, I was just like, yeah, this, he is a Fremen. He is definitely, like...
Like they left him in the desert overnight instead of going back to the trailer. It feels like
the lived experience instead of nobles standing around in fascist architecture and brutalist architecture, right? I am so happy with it. And I'm so happy with how it's like, oh, the war's starting. This is just the beginning. This is a prologue to what we're doing here, right?
Right.
It's a prologue.
You know what else I liked that I thought was funny? Like, people are just, like, people who think, like, this movie is just, like, so serious. I'm like, no, this movie is actually, like, really funny. I love Dave Bautista just getting eaten for lunch in every scene that he's in. It's like, I said it on like, I think my Letterboxd. I was like, Dave Bautista is the coyote and the Fremen are the roadrunners. They're just, like, absolutely wrecking his life. It was, I loved it so much. And it just everything kept going wrong.
Back to the cinematography, right? The one action sequence where Paul and Chani are taking down the
ornithopter.
Ornithopters are there, but the harvester. And she shoots and there's a thing where the guy's aiming for her and then he realizes that it had already gotten hit by the thing, and he's going through the Holtzman shield and everything like that. And then there's this beautiful shot of her running, right? And she's running across in the sand, and you could tell that she's under the thing. And then only, like, it gives it a little bit of time, and after a few moments, then the helicopter crashes behind her and blows up.
Running.
Right?
Yeah, because
you're already onto, you're thinking in your head, what is she running to now? But then it's still, oh, she just destroyed a helicopter. And it's this kind of like, it's comic timing. That was comic timing. But comic timing is just good timing. And drama needs more good timing.
Right.
Right. And action sequences that are so color by numbers, paint by numbers. And you just, oh, let's throw more stuff in there. They don't know this comic timing. When do you have that kind of comic timing now let me
Spielberg
stop saying
is
comic.
Really good at that. That's why his action scenes are so
right.
good.
Harrison Ford shoots the guy with the sword in Indy. That's like boom, right?
That's the only
That's
movie where
memorable...
he shoots the guy with a sword, right?
Well, also he was sick on set that day. They were supposed to have a big fight.
No, I'm making fun of T. He said shoots the guy with not shoot no, the guy holding the sword, shoot
know,
the guy with his sword like
Right. But you remember the scene.
I know
right?
what you're
talking
you
about. Remember
yeah, yeah.
the scene.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You don't remember the scene, idea. Right? So it's that kind of thing, and those kind of things are so important. You know what I mean? I loved when the music goes. I love action sequences where there's no music.
Just the sound. Yeah, I think we looked at each other. We're like, that was awesome.
Yeah, they did. You know,
they did
it
a couple
that,
times
you know,
throughout the movie.
That's not a breakthrough filmmaking. It's done all the time. Lucas did it in the pod racing. Lucas did it in the speeder bike chase. I mean, it's a thing that directors do, right? Because then it gives you time. Talking about winning all the awards, if they don't get the audio effects, audio editing, whatever, what's the award, Ariane? You're the Oscar expert here. What's the most prestigious
like sound editing, sound design?
Yeah, that would be it.
Right, right. If Dune doesn't win that, the Oscars should just end.
Christopher Nolan better be very glad that Dune was delayed, because both of those movies would have gone head to head with each other in all the technical categories for this year.
Right, right, right.
You know, and Dune won swept all those technical categories.
And then the scene where he's going to ride the worm for the first time, and the audio was going, and I'm like in there, and I'm like, I was immersed. And the sand is going, and its things are going, and there's this one shot where it's just a wall of sand, and Paul's just like almost silhouetted there on the sand,
right.
And he looks like a comic book cover of like Batman swinging in,
you,
like
you
in
know
the
what
dark
it's funny you said
return.
Comic book. All those scenes of him riding the worm, it reminded me of Guardians of the Galaxy with Drax and Rocket when they look out the window of the spaceship and you see Ego on the thing And Drax is like, it's a little man. And Rocket's like, no, he's just far away. I just kept thinking about that because he just looked like a little man on that on that worm.
That scene ripped so hard.
Try Hulud.
You know, Ariana, you should go watch the David Lynch version so you could see like how they did those effects versus what they did now.
But those effects were very much for the time.
It's very much a thing of its time. It's just funny. Like, even the suits that they wear with the armor suits.
The steel suits.
Yeah, when you see it in the 1984 version, it's like blocks walking around. It's
Oh, you mean the Holtzman shields?
Yeah, right. Yeah, the ones
the energy shields.
When I tell you, if you stab them slow,
they look like kind of thing, look like energy Gumby. Yeah. They look like energy. The
energy Gumbies is that's a perfect description.
Yeah. But I thought that was cool for the time.
I was telling Spade during the movie, when I watched the first one at home, I just remember being like mad. Not mad, but I was like, I wish I was watching this in the theater. Because I was like, these special effects are insane looking. Like, they are so seamless. And the thing is, like, you watch this, I'm like, I know this giant machine that they have that's harvesting the spice. I was like, I know it's fake. You know, I know the sandworm is fake. Everything is fake, but it looks so good that I'm like, I can't see the seams.
I was not thinking about the special effects. No. It was so good.
Right. Everything looked like it was real within that world where, like, there's certain times where, you know, you see Avengers, I feel like that kind of looks out of place and that whatever. I didn't think that at all.
Because it's in the real world and you get
that's what it is too. Yeah, right.
Just small criticisms. Ladies and gentlemen, this is A-plus film. Small criticisms, okay? There was a couple of weird edits there around when Paul gets to the Siege in the South and is about to take the Water of Life. It kind of dragged a little bit. They could have cut a little bit there. And some moments, it was super appropriate to have slow-motion cloaks floating in the breeze. But you could have cut some. You could take a few minutes off this movie. Not a lot.
There were things that they cut. Like Tim Blake Nelson filmed the whole part and he got cut.
I know. Right. Yeah, I wish he was in there. But see, that's why you need like a
director's cut?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Please put it all in the director's cut.
And Denis Villeneuve said it, like, because people asked him, like, about, like,
he said those scenes are gone, like, basically. Right?
Yeah, he said they're gone. He was like, nobody will ever see them. He was like, because I guess he really just wants the film to exist as it is, which I respect. I respect that a lot because clearly they gave him a lot of control for this movie. They, you know, after the first one did so well.
And you could see it because it was weirder. It was more Dune than the first one.
Yeah.
Because the first one was like, I'm setting up everything and doing the things and I'm setting up the beats and the things. And it was, I think it played it safe.
Also, nobody knew it was part one until the movie came out. They didn't market it as a part one, period.
I knew it was splitting up into being split into two movies from the jump.
I had no idea. I'm pretty sure, like, because none of the posters said part one.
Even before this was announced, I've been following a few people who are Dune people online, and I'm going to give a shout out to one YouTube channel, Quinn's Ideas. Quinn's, you know, two N's, apostrophe S, ideas. He does all these breakdowns of Dune and the world, the universe of Dune and the histories and all these kind of things. You're probably going into dangerous spoiler territory, but if you go, like, what is the Butlerian Jihad? He'll go through it and he won't start talking about, like, what happens and the other things. But Quinn's Ideas. So if you want to go do a deep dive in Dune, that's it.
I'm looking on IMDb right now and it says original title Dune Part 1. But the poster says It Begins, Dune.
That's what I'm saying.
Right.
It wasn't marketed as a two-parter until the what's it called? Until the movie, like, the title came up, it said Dune Part 1 in the title. I was like, Part 1? And I remember that Part
2. You mean the actual movie itself?
Yeah, and I remember Part 2 wasn't announced, like, it wasn't greenlit until like 3 days after it was released. So I think they were probably, like, being cautiously optimistic.
You know what? I do remember that. That Part 2 wasn't a thing. Like, it was basically speculated that it was going to happen, but it wasn't official. I do remember that now.
Well, because Dune was box office poison from the 80s. The David Lynch's Dune was on everybody's lists of the worst movie ever, and it bombed at the box office. No one, so many people lost so much money on that film. But from the jump, when it was announced, they said they're going to do the first novel is going to be the first two films. And I there was never a point that I didn't know that. And probably because I follow YouTube people and kind of thing and those announcements, I'm like, oh, who are they doing? What are they doing? What's it going to be?
Did you like Stellan Skarsgård in the movie, T?
Oh, yeah, Baron Harkonnen. Baron Harkonnen.
I was just going to say, when T was talking about, like, they let him be weird in this movie, like, part one, that's as weird as they got, was the Baron, right?
Right.
Everything else was more straightforward.
Right.
That whole thing with the ink blot fireworks on Harkonnen, which that was
on Getty Prime.
Another criticism, on Getty Prime. The architecture is unlivable, right? Nowhere in anything, anywhere in Villeneuve's Dune, does it look like anybody can live there except for the Fremen tents. Those are the only places looks like you could have had a, like, well, there's a couple of scenes like early on in the first Dune, and maybe on House Carino's, what's House Carino's home planet? Oh my gosh.
Is that the Christopher Walken character?
Yeah, House Carino.
So, that looked like Empire. Game of Thrones type, you know, garden and, right. palace type stuff.
No, Seleucus Segundus is where they have they train the Emperor's army. But anyway, the Emperor's planet, that looked like it's livable, right? You know, when they're sitting down and that kind of thing. But very, very little. Like, it was so weird when the Bene Gesserit is...
Florence Pugh?
What's... No. The blue is the warmest color. What's her name?
Oh, Leah Seydoux.
Yeah.
When they sent the mole to go get Fade.
Fade Rautha, right? And they're like, oh, we're gonna have sex now. I'm like, where? like on that polished obelisk.
They're doing it.
I mean, I know the movie's PG-13, but I think they needed to include a little something, because I'm like, how do you have these two incredibly hot people? Like, Austin Butler is literally the only sexy Harkonnen.
You can't have no thumping, like, in the desert. You're gonna attract a sandworm, Ariane.
We haven't talked about Austin Butler in this. He's so good. He's just like, yes.
Yeah, he did really well.
I was like, you are.
I don't know that I've seen him in another movie, though. I don't know that I've seen
him in another movie. Well, I know he was in Elvis. I
didn't see Elvis.
He was very good in Elvis. He is by far the best thing in Elvis, which is, you know, I am an Elvis apologist.
Better than Tom Hanks?
Tom Hanks is so silly in that movie. He's just playing Colonel Tom Parker like he's Palpatine. I'm not kidding. If you watch it, I'm just like, oh, wow. Tom Hanks is really being a lot. But Austin Butler is very good in Elvis. I will say that for sure. So I'm really glad he's in this. And he's just crazy.
I liked they ratcheted up the Baron Harkonnen in this. Because he's and they showed it in the David Lynch film, and they didn't. Was the David Lynch film rated R?
I can't imagine it was. There's nothing in there that's...
The heart plugs.
Oh, that's right. That wasn't...
And they kind of only show it a little bit in Dune Part 2. But there's this idea that Baron Harkonnen, and this is a family podcast, but I guess you're not going to listen to this with Dune. You know, 10-year-olds aren't watching Dune. But that his attendants, who are like pretty much just sexual slaves, they have... installed heart plugs that you pull it and then the blood starts coming. I don't remember if it's literally in the book, but they referenced it here, because when the Baron was really angry and they're standing outside the door, you hear screams and they come in, and then there's two,
and everybody's dead on the
two
floor.
Bodies. Yeah, you're right. So they're referencing that night, and I'm glad that they allowed Baron Harkonnen to be, you know, even worse, you know, and I think that was really, really important.
He's an interesting character, to say the least.
I'm so thrilled with this movie that, like, story I know, and then the process of a director bringing it to the choices they make, and I go, would I made that choice? And a lot of the joy I get from films like this is that, so much so that this summer, I'm going to read Heretics of Dune and Children of Dune. I think that Villeneuve is taking a break. He's going to do another movie, and then he says he's coming back for at least one, and he wants to wrap up the Paul story. I don't know what that means because my memory is confused about the two things. I think that means he's only doing Dune Messiah. Let's say Dune Messiah is a failure. Just happenstance. This is just a rhetorical thought. This movie has already done so well. What is it? 170 million worldwide opening weekend, right? Is that the number?
It's budget 190. Box office, just currently on Wikipedia, is at 182 after one weekend.
Okay.
So it's pretty much, you know, made its budget back.
Right. So even if the next Villeneuve would be a flop, and it's not going to be a flop because if it's only half as good as this, that's still pretty good. Right. That's still pretty good.
Yeah.
Right. But he got it right. So I think he's going to take the time to kind of figure out to go forward with what's going on.
Real quick, T. So he has three projects in development. Rendezvous with Rama, whatever that is, says in development.
Right, 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 right. Clones in Space.
Cleopatra's pre-production, which I think is his next movie.
Cleopatra, like a historical epic?
Yeah.
Is that the one with Gal Gadot in it?
I'm going to look it up for you right now. It doesn't have any cast listed.
Okay, so probably not.
But it does have like a movie poster and it's Cleopatra doesn't really say much. But then after that, it says Dune Part 3 in production. So I guess they're starting to do like all the previs and all that kind of stuff on it now.
It says here the name is Dune Prophecy. Oh no, I'm sorry. Sorry, excuse me. Dune Prophecy is an upcoming science fiction
Is that the HBO series. Max show? Yeah. There's an HBO Max show that's coming out.
Oh, with the Bene Gesserit.
Right.
Yeah, focusing on the origins of the Bene Gesserit.
I saw some like fake-ass films, too, saying Sands of Dune.
They have a cast.
Is it people from the movie?
Emily Watson is the lead, it looks like. I like Emily Watson. She was in Chernobyl.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I don't think Villeneuve will do Children of Dune. You know, I don't want to get into any spoilers because I see how he could wrap up at the end of Dune Messiah what he wanted to do.
Is that because it goes off the deep end or something?
I don't want to give any spoilers or anything like that. Sorry. There's time shifts and like jumping into the story moves on. I think, though, that to do Dune, you have to make it all the way to God Emperor of Dune. I think you have to make it all the way to God Emperor of Dune. I think what's going to happen is Villeneuve will do the third, and then he'll be an executive producer on Children of Dune.
Or studio write him a blank Emperor check and say make it happen.
Right, right, right. You know what? He gets tired. I mean, listen, he's my age, right? Putting these films together is a lot of work. It's a lot of your life. It's the last 10 years of his life, right? How long ago did Dune come out? The first part?
2021. So figure what? 2.5, 3 years before that?
Yeah, 2.5, 3 years. So it's better part of a decade, right? That's a lot of your life.
Yeah.
Right? And he's going to do it again, right? And it's a three-year process, right? Especially because they let him be the auteur.
I wonder if they shift things around and just tell him to film them both at the same time kind of thing.
No, because it's different.
Can't do it.
I have to read the books again. I don't want to say it. I mean, you could film Children of Dune and God Emperor of Dune, you could film those two at the same time. But you have to get to God Emperor of Dune. And I think they will. I think that Villeneuve will be an executive producer and they'll like hand it off. I wish I took notes because there's so many other things I wanted to say. We're already over an hour.
Yeah, I was just going to ask, anything else you guys want to bring up? Because I got one nitpick, T. I know, you know, you love hearing my nitpicks, but I have the same complaint with this movie that I had with the Peter Jackson King Kong movie. They trank King Kong and you see him sitting there and in the background is the boat. How the hell did they get him on the boat? They never showed you. That was my one pet peeve. That was the one thing I was looking forward to watching that movie. And then they did the same move here. They called all the sandworms and the next scene is everybody on the sandworm and then it's everybody off the sandworm. I want to know how they got on the freaking worm. That's what I want to know.
Well, David Lynch showed that they were repelling.
They were climbing off up the side. Yeah, it was very much like Mandalorian climbing on the side of the
crawler. I didn't even notice that. The only time I thought that is, how did they get Lady Jessica? What do you call it when they the
in the basket?
Litter is when they Yeah, what do you call that when you carry around emperors? It's called a litter where they have people like.
I know what you're talking about.
How do they get? How do they get that litter up at the top?
When they show Paul, you know, get on that giant worm, it was such like a dramatic, you know, drawn out, and you could see how difficult it was for him. And those things are not slowing down. So what do? You get one guy out there, he hops on, then you call him like an Uber, and they
a pulley or something in a bag.
But the worms aren't stopping. That's my thing.
In terms of storytelling, that was the first time he was doing something, right? Let's make pretend something like, I don't know, making love. That first time, it's more intense. You're about to mess up. It's like this. It's like that. But then at the sandworms, come on. You know what those are.
I know what you're doing.
But
yeah,
you go,
yeah,
you know,
the
it
AMC
just, you do it over and over again. Right. The popcorn bucket. So
we did not go to AMC.
Is,
I did not get one.
It's Paul's first time, so it's communicating the intensity of that experience. But Chami just goes, hey, bump, 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 calling the Uber and gets on there, and she could do it because she's a pro at it, right? Jumping out of an airplane is a very intense experience. Is it for the guys who are you're strapped to, who do it every day? You know what I mean? There's no such thing as a perfect film, and this gets pretty damn close.
Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at NotAllPods. Visit us on our website at NotAllPodcastWearCapes.com. And send us an email, NotAllPods@gmail.com. Also subscribe and listen to us on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, and Google Play.
Not All Podcasts Wear Capes is a Thaumaturge Wonderworks production.
What happened to your fingy?
My finger? Long story.
Yeah. Stuck it in the box.
mother hold a needle right. to your neck. Do you say Harkonnen or Harkonnen? Because they say Harkonnen.
I say Harkonnen.
It depends if it's David Lynch or Denny Villeneuve.
I've been saying it for 30 years. I'm not going to all of a sudden start correcting because